for you. With us, we have Judy Gala, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Vice Director of the Direction of the United States, and Ulises Cabo, he is also from the division. So he will talk to you as you have asked us about the relations between Cuba and the United States. Okay?
Buenos días. ¿Cómo están ustedes? So should I continue in Spanish? Oh, sorry about that. Well, I'll try to do my best within my limited knowledge of the English language. First of all, good morning to you all. And I, from the outset, I'd like to start by expressing our warm welcome from the office in which I work, which is the General Division on the U.S. Affairs at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Cuba. With me is one of my colleagues. His name is Ulises. He's a young diplomat, just graduated from the institution that we have. And our intention is to share with you some ideas related to the Cuba-U.S. relationship. I'm sure that you have heard a lot not only in the United States, but also during your visit to Cuba. I'm sure that your meetings with Mrs. Kenia Serrano and Ricardo Alarcón went well, and I'm sure they touched upon a number of issues of your interest. So my intention would be to follow up on those ideas and to try to convey or to answer some of your questions. I will start by making a general comment, and then I will be happy to receive some of your questions as well. First, I would like to say that perhaps it would be important to reemphasize that a new stage in Cuba-U.S. affairs has just begun. And that started in December 17 of last year. The previous stage, if I can say that, existed up to that moment. And that stage, you know it pretty well. It was characterized by a difficult, very difficult relationship, open confrontation, and obviously an essential element that's still present, which is the policy of blockade against Cuba. We are entering, as I said, into a new stage. We are moving into a phase in which we want to go beyond that era or phase of open confrontation to a one that, first of all, is aiming at reestablishing the diplomatic ties between our two countries. As a first step towards a process which would be long, complex, process that we call of normalizing, towards the normalization of bilateral relations. And I think it's important to recall where we come from in terms of our relationship. And obviously, as I said from the outset, an important feature should be kept in mind when we talk about the Cuba-U.S. affairs, which is the policy of blockade. As all of you know, that policy, although there are some announcements related to that, but the essential elements of the blockade are still in effect. Since that blockade was codified in a law, or by law, by the United States Congress in 1996. But it's important to recall that that policy of blockade has caused for a number of decades enormous harm to the Cuban people, not only in terms of human resources, but also in terms of economic resources as well. And obviously, when we are referring to the policy of blockade, obviously we have to keep in mind a number of import or legislation that have been passed over the years by the US Congress. And obviously we have to refer, for example, to laws starting from 1961, 1963, the 1992, as you recall, the Torricelli Bill, which was approved at that year, and obviously 1996, the Helms-Burton Act. And even in 2000, there was also a set of legislation that set up a number of additional restrictions codifying to law, which, by the way, prohibits travel to Cuba for touristic purposes. So that restriction emanated from a legislation passed in the year 2000. Obviously, that policy of blockade has been denounced by Cuba over the years, as you well know, and obviously by a number of governments in our international community. And I think the more clear illustration of the level of denunciation that that policy has had over the years is very well reflected in the voting that every year since the 90s has taken place in the United States, in the United Nations General Assembly. When that exercise started, as you know, in the early 90s, only a number of countries voted in favor of that resolution, and the support has grown exponentially up to a point that last year more than 180 countries voted in favor of that resolution, 188 to be more precise. So we have come from a difficult situation in the case of Cuba, but fortunately the support for the lifting, the necessity of lifting that policy of blockade has grown as well exponentially. And not only at the level of the United Nations, but also in other countries, as I said, but more importantly, within the United States. And I would say that visits such as yours clearly show the number of, the level of support that there is in the United States for a better relationship with Cuba. On December 17th of last year, important announcements were made by the President of Cuba and the President of the United States. There are common messages in those announcements, and perhaps one of the more important announcements was the issue of the decision to reestablish diplomatic relations between our two nations. But there were also a recognition that profound differences are still there, but nonetheless, there is a will to move towards normalization of relations. Another important topic from the Cuba's statement, from Raul Castro's statement, is the willingness to hold a respectful dialogue with the United States government based on respect to our sovereignty, to the independence of Cuba. And the idea of that dialogue is to have an exchange of views on a reciprocal basis. And I would say that that is a very important principle for our relations to the United States. There were also some other additional ideas that were mentioned, including, for example, our willingness to cooperate in multilateral bodies, such as the United Nations. And obviously, President Raul Castro reiterated and reaffirmed that notwithstanding the desire to reestablish diplomatic relations and to move towards normalization of relations, the blockade is still there. And it was important to have that in mind. The repercussions or the implications of those allocations, of those statements, both from Barack Obama and from Raul Castro, obviously, were well received by the international community as a whole, not only in Latin America, not only in the Caribbean, but also in other regions of the world. And there are a number of statements by presidents, high-level officials, individuals from different walks of life expressing support to that step in the bilateral relationship between Cuba and the United States. And I think it's important to keep that in mind as well. I think the US president reiterated his desire to engage Congress when he addressed the nation in his State of the Union speech, and he reiterated that he would like to engage Congress in order to seek the lifting of the blockade, as we call it. After that, I think it's important to recall that there were publications or announcements by the Department of Trade and the Department of Commerce in terms of the adjustments made to the regulations which obviously implement sanctions against Cuba. And that publication of the new regulations or the adjustments to the new regulations were, as I said, published back in January the 16th or 15th. So from the announcement by President Barack Obama until the new adjustments to the regulations were made public, there was about a month. So we are in the process, obviously, of analyzing the scope and content of those changes to the regulations to the implementation of the blockade. And from our side, we saw those announcements, measures, in the right direction, I mean, as a step in the right direction, but obviously the adjustment to the regulations are limited in scope, the way we see it, because there are still a number of issues which are still there in terms of the blockade, but obviously there are some positive movements in terms of the way the blockade has been implemented, and the measures announced by the US side are aimed at modifying some aspects of the implementation of the blockade. In our case, we would like to reiterate that President Barack Obama has prerogative executive power to continue making new adjustments to the way the blockade has been implemented. There are only three or four exceptions or areas in which, by law, he cannot go beyond that. And perhaps those of the four issues that he cannot actually address are the issues, for example, related to tourism with Cuba. There is also the issue of transactions with companies, as they mentioned, were nationalized by Cuba, and that issue has been codified in the Hans-Borten Act. As I said, the trade with subsidiaries of the US in other countries is also something that the President of the United States cannot modify because it's codified into law by the Torricelli Act. And the issue of trips by the US citizens to Cuba for touristic purposes, as was codified by the relevant legislation in 2000. Another issue that cannot be modified by precedent is the issue of credits to the transactions that we have in terms of agricultural products. And obviously that implies that Cuba has to pay in cash when it comes to the purchasing of agricultural products from the United States. So no credit is allowed to Cuba, and that has been codified by law from the relevant legislation in 2000. Aside from those four issues, there are a wide variety of possibilities by the US president to continue modifying aspects of the blockade. And we have said it publicly that, and our president also mentioned that, that it would be important that the president of the United States continue exploring or making adjustments to those, to the implementation of the blockade, so that we might end up having just the structural part of the blockade, but there are a number of other issues that can be allowed. What can be allowed by executive powers of the United States president? I would mention, for example, some elements. For example, the as I said, the to allow Cuba to make transactions in US dollars. Today, that is a prohibition, and obviously it presents a number of challenges to Cuba. The importation by the US of products which has Cuban resources or spare parts or other elements is not allowed at this very moment. Cuba cannot import anything aside from what has been already allowed from the United States. So there is no free trade between Cuba and the United States. Just to mention a number of restrictions that are still there. And I think that this is something that has to be kept in mind when we approach this new stage of bilateral relations. I also think that the new changes in the regulations obviously presents opportunities, challenges, but I think it's part of the process. As we mentioned at the beginning, we are entering this new phase of relations with the idea that notwithstanding the profound political differences that both governments have, I think we have to learn, and we have said it also, we have to learn the art of coexisting each other in a civilized manner. And there are a number of examples that prove that there are opportunities in terms of cooperation, bilateral cooperation in areas of mutual interest. For example, how to work together to address or to mitigate an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, how to cooperate in areas of environment in general, areas of aviation, I mean security to flights, the area of earthquake prevention, mitigation, those kind of things. Because obviously we are neighboring countries and there are a number of issues that are common challenges to both countries. So there are opportunities for that kind of, for those bilateral cooperation. In January we had, as you know, the first round of discussions aimed at finding the ways and means to formalize the decisions announced by our respective presidents, meaning to reestablish diplomatic relations. But obviously that idea, that decision, that desire has to be formalized as per the relevant international conventions, and we had that first set of conversations in Havana in January. And I think that was the first step, the first meeting, in order to achieve that purpose. But the reestablishment of diplomatic relations, and that's another idea I would like to emphasize, is the a very important action, a very important, I would say, endeavor, but it's just the starting of a process towards normalization of bilateral relations. Because obviously, to open an embassy and to start functioning at the level of diplomatic relations with certain normalcy is just one step in that complex process of normalizing the entire bilateral relationship, which is not limited to the diplomatic field, as you know. So there are a number of issues from the Cuban side that we have mentioned in relevant interviews, which are of importance to Cuba when it comes to normalizing the bilateral relationship. And obviously, we have to reiterate the issue of the lifting of the U.S. blockade, which, as you know, is a unilateral policy. So there are a number of unilateral policies that have been imposed over the years that have no, I would say, similar actions from Cuba. So we haven't imposed restrictions or sanctions to the United States. So there's nothing we can do in return for the lifting of the embargo. We haven't included the United States in any list of states sponsoring terrorism. So it's the other way around. And obviously, there's nothing we can exchange for that. There are other issues such as setting up specific TV stations that has also to be addressed. There's no a TV station in Cuba or a radio station that was set up specifically to try to change the nature of the U.S. as a country. It's the other way around. So obviously, in this process of normalizing relations, there are a number of unilateral policies that, in our thinking, have to be removed. Obviously, there are other issues that merit a bilateral solution, so to speak. And obviously, we're referring to the respective demands for compensation. There are requests or demands for compensation for companies which were duly nationalized by the government of Cuba at the time. And there are requests for compensation from our side because of the damages caused by hostile policies to our people, not only in material resources, but also in the human toll of those policies. And obviously, there are other issues regarding trademarks and related activities that can be handled. We can find a solution. But as I said, as you imagine, those are very complex issues that merits a number of discussions. It's difficult to say how long that process will take, but obviously there is a will from our side to engage in that direction. And going back to one of the unilateral policies which we think have to be removed is the issue of placing Cuba in the so-called list of state sponsoring international terrorism. As you know, Cuba was placed without justification in 1982 in that list, which currently have, I think, three or four other countries, Syria, and Iran, perhaps some other countries.
Sudan, Syria, and Iran.
Exactly. So Cuba was placed in that list since 1982. And for us, every time that issue is touched upon and is mentioned, it's really something that is quite sensitive. And quite sensitive because Cuba has been a victim of terrorism over the years. I mean, there have been a number of actions organized, perpetrated, financed from the United States territory against Cuba. And as a result of that, more than 3,000 persons, Cubans, have died because of those terrorist actions, and more than 2,000 have been maimed because of those actions. So it's an important, a very difficult human toll for us. So when you are placed in a list saying that you are sponsoring international terrorism, it can be interpreted by the relevant families and by the population as a whole as a very, very difficult situation. And we have said it also for many years that from Cuba, there hasn't been any act organized, terrorist act organized against the United States territory. As a matter of fact, Cuba has a very consistent record of fighting terrorism, preventing terrorism. We have ratified, signed, we have become state parties to the most important international instruments when it comes to the prevention and fighting of terrorism. There's no a single example one can put to say that Cuba has allowed a terrorist action against the United States. And more importantly, our will is that we will never allow that to happen. So this is something that has to be resolved. The issue of reestablishment of diplomatic relations also entail a number of important aspects, as we see. Currently, our intersection in Washington, the Cuban intersection in Washington, doesn't have a bank. So for a diplomatic mission to function without a bank is something which is very difficult. So how can we reestablish diplomatic relations without a bank for our intersection in Washington, which at the moment is functioning by paying in cash, the usual services. I mean, if you have to pay the bill of electricity bill or whatever you have to pay in cash. There's no, we don't have credit cards, debit cards, nothing like that because we don't have a bank. And as you know, we also, in our intersection in Washington, we provide consular services to a number of citizens, both Cuban citizens and US citizens. And to handle those services without having a bank is a very difficult situation because of a number of risks associated with the moving of cash, you know, for those transactions. So this is something that has to be kept in mind as well as we move along this process of reestablishment of diplomatic relations. Again, a step in the overall picture of a process of normalizing bilateral relations. The other issues, as I mentioned, is it would be difficult to explain the reestablishment of diplomatic relations when Cuba continues to be placed in the so-called list of states sponsoring terrorism. And this is something that, at the moment, allows a number of individuals to present demands because of the placing of Cuba in that list. And there is a history of not only frozen funds from Cuba in the United States because of the blockade, but also a history of funds which have been unduly taken in order to satisfy those demands presented in courts in the United States. So this is another issue that has to be resolved, as we think. So just to sum up, I think, yes, we are entering into a new phase in our bilateral relations. It's a complex process. There is a willingness from both sides to reestablish diplomatic relations as a first and important step. We really saw with satisfaction is something which is positive, the desire expressed by President Obama to engage the United States Congress in finding a way to lifting the blockade. And we have seen that as a positive step. But obviously, how the Congress of the United of U.S. Congress will react to that, it remains to be seen. There are a number of legislators that do share the need to lift the embargo, or the blockade, as we call it. But obviously, it might take some time. So from us, it's something that we will approach that process step by step. But bearing in mind what we have mentioned, that we have to find the way to, or to learn the art of coexisting in a civilized manner. And I would like to stop here to entertain some questions. Let me also, before stopping my initial statement, say that we have come to this moment of a new phase in our bilateral relationship, not by accident. I have to say that, and it should be said, that in that specific action of statements made back in December 17, 2014, at least from our side, that sums up a history of resistance that have lasted more than 5 decades since the starting of the triumph of the Cuban Revolution. So there is a very important actor when it comes to explaining why we have come to this specific moment in history, which is the Cuban people. As I and many people have mentioned, the heroic Cuban people who have endured over the years many hardships and still are facing a number of hardships due to that policy of blockade, aggressions of different sorts, terrorist actions. So the human toll has been huge. When we addressed this important issue, and another important element to explain why we have come to this point is the international solidarity. Aside or outside the United States and within the United States. And when you look at the Latin American and Caribbean region right now, you are looking at a different situation in that region. If you recall back in the 60s of the 20th century, well, Cuba was almost isolated in our hemisphere. In the early 60s, we had a handful of countries to which we had diplomatic relations. Right now, we have diplomatic relations with all the nations, countries in the Americas, but the United States. And we are about to reestablish diplomatic relations with the United States when we finish this first phase. So that shows how, over the years, that resistance has earned support in Latin America, the Caribbean, and internationally as well. So this is another factor that has to be kept in mind in order to explain why we have come to this specific moment. There are a number of organizations which have included Cuba. Just to mention perhaps the more recent is CELAC, the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States. Cuba had the possibility of presiding over, for a year, that organization. So we had a presidency for a year, and we tried to promote peace in our hemisphere and a number of specific projects based on the idea that we have unity within the diversity in the Americas. So there are other organizations in which Cuba has been participating over the years. And I think internationally, the presence of Cuba also has been gathering support, not only in New York, in the headquarters of the United Nations, but also in Geneva and other multilateral fora. And obviously, the solidarity within the United States, which has been important, has been so important over the years. For a number of issues, general issues, the issue of the lifting of the blockade, but also specific issues which have been sensitive to the Cuban population, such as you recall, the return of Elian Gonzalez some years ago. Fidel Castro himself mentioned the importance of the solidarity support that we found in the US population when it comes to that specific case of Elian Gonzalez. So Elian Gonzalez has been here for many years. He has been growing up. He's a youngster, and obviously happily reunited with his family here. And more recently, the case of the Cuban Five, which you know pretty well as well. And we, again, in that case of the Cuban Five, we also received a lot of support within the United States. And today we have the five Cuban anti-terrorist fighters here reunited with their families and with their people as well. So I just wanted to clarify that before entertaining some of the questions that you might have. Again, thank you very much.
So we had many questions in very little time because I know you have to leave us soon. So we'll try to get as many as we can. And some of these are clarifying questions. If the State Department does give a positive report that Cuba should be taken off the terrorist list and the president agrees and goes to Congress 45 days, that could all happen within the next several months. Which of the financial restrictions, separate from the larger embargo issues, would be lifted with Cuba being taken off the terrorist list?
Should I? Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much for that important question. Well, as part of the announcement by President Obama back in December was precisely the instructions he gave to the relevant departments to review the placing of Cuba in the list of state sponsoring international terrorism. And that is a process that obviously the US side can explain better. But my understanding is that it would take the president to send a report to the US Congress after the review has ended with whatever recommendation they might have. It remains to be seen what would be that recommendation from the government of the United States to the Congress. But after that report is sent to the Congress, there is a period, my understanding, of 45 days for the Congress to react. So we have to see what kind of recommendation they would send to Congress. But I have to emphasize that there are a number of important documents, statements from Cuba made over the years in which we have reiterated that Cuba has no intention whatsoever of organizing, allowing, financing any terrorist acts against the United States, and will never allow that to happen. And also that there is a history for Cuba being a victim of terrorist acts. There is ample information that can be uploaded or downloaded from internet and from the relevant sources, in which we show what we have been doing when it comes to combating international terrorism. As you know, the Security Council of the United Nations has a number of committees dealing with those issues, and they request member states to report based on those relevant resolutions from the US Security Council. So Cuba consistently have presented the relevant reports from our side, expressing what we have been doing to comply with those UN resolutions dealing with combating international terrorism. And here in Cuba, at the parliament and at the relevant bodies, we also have addressed those issues, and there is ample evidence that shows that Cuba never should have been placed in that list, and still the mere placing of Cuba in that list is really an affront to the Cuban people, if I can put it in that way.
So the second part of that question is, which of the financial limitations will be lifted by taking Cuba off of that list?
Frankly speaking, it's difficult to say, because as I know, the placing of a country in such a list obviously will trigger a number of restrictions when it comes to financing. But in the case of Cuba, I'm not sure about other countries in that list, but in the case of Cuba, there is a terrible combination of being in that list with the existence of the blockade. So even if you are taken out of that list, there are still a number of regulation restrictions that will trigger similar implications when it comes to international transactions. And just to mention an example, recently a number of banks have been really fined with skyrocketing figures when it comes to transactions with Cuba, because of Cuba is a country subject to an embargo or a blockade. Obviously, after 9/11, internationally and domestically, there have been a set of legislation put in place to monitor more closely the flows of financial assets. And as I said, the combination of the unjustified placing of Cuba in that list plus the blockade is really a terrible challenge for Cuba. So it remains to be seen what restrictions would be taken out once Cuba is removed from that list of states sponsoring international terrorism.
So there's a number of questions that deal with the benefits to Cuba of normalization relation when it comes to trade. Could you tell us what the products? Is it all agricultural products that are already allowed to be imported into Cuba? Somebody asked, is Cuba concerned about the importation of genetically modified GMO products? And also, what are the products that Cuba is most interested in getting from the U.S. that you can't get now?
Thank you for that question as well. Well, if you look at the report that Cuba sends to the United Nations annually, if you look at the report that Cuba has been sending to the United Nations over the years as part of compliance to the relevant resolutions related to the blockade, you will find a summary of the impact that policy of blockade is having on the Cuba's economy and the opportunities in terms of trade that have been missing by both countries because of that outdated policy. For example, in the area of services, tourism, in the case of trade, obviously we have leading products, very well known internationally, such as our rum, our cigars, those kind of things. But
very healthy products.
one of the things that I have to also illustrate is that I'm not saying for sure in a normal context that would be one of the commodities or products that can be exchanged, but at least do present an opportunity, is in the area of biotechnology and pharmaceuticals. And yes, I mentioned cigar, but I'm mentioning now biotechnology and pharmaceuticals. So there is a balance there. And I think that, you know, usually there is an image that portrays developing country, in general terms, being unable to go beyond the usual commodities, the usual, I would say, goods, you know. Depending on the country, it can be mining, it can be agricultural products. In our case, sugar. That's the, you know, an image that have been portrayed over the years. But in the case of Cuba, because of the huge investment that we have made in terms of human capital, we can now say that we have an important industry, biotechnology industry, that which is able to venture in areas which were really limited to a few countries in the world. And we have even products that are unique that could be of interest for the US population. And just to mention an important example is the Heverprop P medication or product, which is for the diabetic foot ulcers and those kind of things. And Cuba has developed that product, has been marketing in a number of countries in the Americas, and I'm not sure what the, you know, how huge or large is the diabetic population in the United States, but okay, well, that product is being developed by Cuba, and it has had very positive results when it comes to reducing the amputation of food because of that terrible, you know, ulcers which are developed occasionally. And obviously this is an opportunity. And it only shows, you know, one example of the opportunities. And in terms of other areas, services, I think there are other opportunities as well, because we may have other products of interest for the US economy, for the US population. But again, the area of health, scientific research, joint scientific research, are areas of opportunities in a possible normal trade relationship between both countries.
So one of the questions said that the US government is now coming up with a list of things that Cuba would be able to export to the US, but none of them would be products produced by government agencies, only by private sector. Will that be a positive benefit to Cuba?
Well, as I mentioned at the outset, the new regulations or the adjustments to the regulations that are administered by the Department of Trade and the Department of Commerce have been reviewed by the relevant agencies in Cuba. We are in that process as we speak, and I'm sure we will provide a general response or specific responses when time comes. But having said that, I would say that it only shows the limitations or the limited scope of the recent measures announced by the US government when it comes to the process of normalizing relationship. So if you are not allowing government agencies or companies to engage in a normal trade, well, that only shows that we have a lot of work to do. in order to really have a normal relationship. And that idea is also related to one important message that we have conveyed over the years, which is, yes, we in Cuba, we have a difficult situation in terms of our economic limitations and a number of hardships and other limitations that we may have and have. And what we say is that the main cause for that is that policy of US blockade. Others may have a different opinion, but we are convinced that the US blockade is the main cause for the problems, major problems that we have when it comes to the development of our economy. So for us, it's important to remove that obstacle and to allow, without exceptions, a normal relationship, including trade, between both nations. So limited trade was allowed to non-state companies in Cuba, but the companies of our government are not allowed to trade, only with the exception of agricultural product, which, as you know, is a very difficult trade because you have to pay in cash, not by using credits. So there's still a lot of work to do on that front as well.
So there's a question about the copyright issue. Does Cuba respect copyrights from anywhere? And we've seen from the Cuban people how much information has been shared because Cuba does not respect copyrights. This will obviously be something that will have to change, and might this be a negative thing for information exchange?
As I said, there are a number of issues that we have to discuss bilaterally, and one of those issues are the ones related to trademarks in general. And as you know, you are mentioning copyrights, but in the case of our industrial rights, so to speak, we have seen what has happened in terms of the trade of our Havana Club rum in the United States. And so there are a number of outstanding issues when it comes to trademarks and related issues that have to be discussed bilaterally. And that is another component of the process aimed at normalizing bilateral relations between both countries. So yes, it's an outstanding issue. It might be complex, but we have to address that issue as well from both sides.
Okay. There's a confusion among people about how much the blockade affects Cuba's ability to trade with other countries. Could you clarify that?
Yes. And I think that goes to the concept, or rather the term that we use. We hear the term embargo. But embargo gives the impression that it's just an issue between Cuba and the United States. So we cannot import goods or services from the United States, and we are not allowed to export those goods or services to the United States. Full stop. That is not the truth. The blockade, and we use the term blockade, goes beyond that illustration of being a bilateral issue. Is the blockade has extraterritorial effects, which are very clear. Lots of information is available on that issue. If you go to the Cuban relevant websites, the Cuban reports to the United Nations every year that shows what are the impact when it comes to the extraterritorial effect of the blockade. So when you analyze, for example, the prohibition for Cuba to enter or to engage in a transaction with subsidiaries of US companies abroad, then you are not referring only to goods and services going back and forth between Cuba and the United States. So, for example, if a company, a US company, has a subsidiary in Belgium, Cuba cannot import goods or services from that company in Belgium, notwithstanding that they are there, they may have workers from Belgium, but still it's a subsidiary of the United States, and we cannot trade with that company. The same applies to the prohibition for companies in the United States to import any goods which may contain Cuban raw materials, for example. If a company in Japan is willing to sell steel to the United States, that's just an example, and that has a component of a raw material from Cuba, like nickel or whatever, that is not allowed from happening. So obviously, you are entering into a very difficult situation. It goes beyond the usual trade between both countries. The same applies for Cuba. If Cuba is interested in importing a vaccine developed by country X, and that vaccine has more than 10% of components from the US, we cannot import that vaccine. And we had a recent example when we entered into the oil drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. In order for us to try to approach the resources which are there, because as you know, Cuba is heavily dependent of oil resources. We are able to satisfy half of our current demands, but we have to import the other half. So for a developing country, it's a challenge. So we enter into that process of exploring oil reserves in the Gulf of Mexico. But that is a very costly industry, as you know. So for us to get into an exploration project, it demands a platform to be set up there. And to find a platform with less than 10% of components made in the United States is a real challenge, or had been a real challenge up to 2012. So for our case, a platform, is an oil rig, had to be manufactured specifically for Cuba to get into that project. Because the other rigs in the world, which are being provided, obviously would have components from the US. The US is perhaps the leading country in terms of technology for those oil rigs. So those are the kind of challenges that we have when it comes to the implications of the extraterritorial effect of the blockade.
So we have a lot more questions, and unfortunately, Mr. Gala Lopez does not have time and has to go on. What I think that Code Pink might commit to do is we can answer some of these questions ourselves. Some of them, maybe we could get our wonderful interns to do some research on and put it up on our FAQs when we get back. And others of them pertain to international relations between Cuba and other countries. There's a number of questions about Cuba's relations with Israel. Many people in this group have been working on issues related to Palestine and want to know what Cuba's doing on that front. So maybe you could put us in touch with somebody else from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs who could answer some of those questions. Would that be possible?
Well, we will do our best to entertain those efforts, those interests. Obviously, we have in our ministry a range of offices dealing with the different regions of the world, so we will get back to you on that. But I, before stopping my comments, I would like to again reiterate our deep appreciation for your visit to Cuba. Certainly for me and for my colleague here, it's really an honor to have the opportunity to interact directly with you. I know that perhaps for some of you it's the first visit to Cuba. Others have been here a number of times. But my advice for those who are here for the first time is to go and talk to the people here. Yes, we have shortages. We have a number of difficult situations here, but our people is our main asset. And if we are talking about those issues right now, it's because we have been able to endure more than 5 decades of hostility, and that shows something about a country. And yes, you will realize that there are different opinions in our society on how to move forward with that bilateral relationship or with other areas here in Cuba, but you will find, above all, consensus in terms of continuity of the project that we have chosen many years ago and which is enshrined in our constitution. And that has a tremendous level of support here. So continuity is something, obviously, updating what we have to update, because that's another issue in which we have embarked on in the recent years, in order to update our economic and social model, in order to put it in, in tone with the new challenges of the 21st century, and especially with our objective as a society. And I wanted to also mention that you will be meeting many people who were born after the blockade was put in place for the first time. So it's not by coincidence, it's because that policy has lasted too much. And yes, many of us, when we were born, the policy of blockade were there. Even your current president was born when the blockade was imposed. So I think we have that in common, all of us, from our side here. And we have to get rid of that outdated policy. And the Cuban people, I can say that, that's my personal opinion, is interested in fostering relations at the personal level as well, because of the simple fact that we are neighbors. There is a common history between our peoples. There are a number of examples that shows that that relationship between Cuba and the United States goes beyond 1959. As a matter of fact, we have a team of doctors who have been dispatched to a number of countries in order to address emergencies. And that, for example, contingent is called Henry Reef, which is something I'm sure you know pretty well in your history. And we're talking about a person back in the history of our bilateral relation from the 19th century. So a person who came to Cuba to fight for the independence of Cuba as well when we were a colony of Spain. And over the years, there are a number of examples that shows that there have been important linkages and there are a common bond that have been forged over the years. So I think we have to, as peoples, as nations, we have to stand up for what is beneficial to our respective countries, notwithstanding specific groups' interests that may be, resorting to keeping the status quo in the United States. So we are willing to moving forward as government towards the normalization of diplomatic relations or the bilateral relationship. And again, we have, and I want to repeat that, we have to learn the art of coexisting in a civilized manner to deal with our differences, but also to take advantage of the great opportunities that are there for our relationship. Thank you very much.
So everyone needs to stay seated because he really needs to get to his next speech. We have questions to answer And the rest of the tour, if you go over
this retired U.S. diplomat, well done, and thank you.
Thank you.